Hi everybody, Steve Savitsky. Welcome back to Savitsky Talks. And today we have Rabbi Zev Elif. And Rabbi Elif is a, soon will be Dr. Elif, getting a PhD in American Jewish History from Brandeis, and written a very interesting article for the Jewish Action. So it's a pleasure to have you on the show. How are you, Rabbi Elif?
Very well, thank you, Mr. Savitsky, for having me on.
Thank you. My pleasure. So the article I found really, really fascinating because I think people don't focus on this at all. And you're kind of taking us back 60 years, Brown versus the Board of Education. So let's talk a little bit about where was the country at that time? What was going on right before Brown versus the Board of Education and right after? And then we'll talk a little bit about what happened in the Orthodox Jewish world and the Jewish world.
Sure. So there's quite a bit of literature, obviously, in the general history and history of education, history of civil rights. That literature is quite vast. Since the 1930s, the civil rights movement, the NAACP, with Thurgood Marshall, of course, had been taking on cases, trying to reach a landmark case that would really destroy Plessy versus Ferguson, that would really call segregation unconstitutional. So in the early 1950s, Marshall finally found his case. It was going to be Brown versus Board of Education in Topeka, Kansas. And this was the case of a young girl who wanted to learn at a different school, and this was going to be their case. It wasn't just Thurgood Marshall, but by all accounts, Earl Warren, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court at the time, desperately wanted a unanimous decision. That's what he received. There's literature about President Eisenhower at the time and how involved he was in the decision. I think that's still a matter of scholarly debate to see what role Eisenhower had at the time, but certainly America, by and large, public opinion, wanted desperately a unanimous decision by the Supreme Court to finally end segregation in America.
And when the Supreme Court ruled on the case, so how did it change the world, okay, you know, the American world, and how did, generally speaking, the Jewish world react to it?
Well, in the world, that's really, really interesting. There's a growing literature about what exactly Brown versus Board did for global politics, taking us back into the 1940s, 1950s with the Cold War. One of the arguments made by the Soviet Union was, look what capitalism, look what America does in its own borders. The argument for the communists was segregation could never ever happen in a socialist environment. American values are backward. So Brown versus Board, perhaps motivated by an anti-communist impulse, really meant that America could morally be on equal footing with their opponents in the Cold War. So it was a sensational moment in the annals of American history, and Jews, by and large, were in favor of it. Certainly the reform and conservative movements. This article that I've written explores the history of the Orthodox involvement. Of course, the day school movement, Torah Masorah, was founded in 1944. The first day schools were founded already in 1916, I believe, was the Talmud Bavli Academy, MTA, as we know it today. And then 1937 was Hillel, Ramaz, and Maimonides, where I teach in Brookline, at the time in Roxbury. So the day school movement was underway. It didn't have an immediate impact, therefore, on the Orthodox community as far as day school, for schooling for their children was concerned. But certainly this was a rally that all could participate in.
Right. But, I mean, you know, when we think about the civil rights movement, you know, we kind of conjure up the picture of Heschel, you know, being out there marching in the demonstrations in Selma. And, you know, you don't see, I don't think you see a lot of yarmulkes there. You know, you talk about, you know, what was the reaction of the Orthodox Jewish world to this, and it seemed to be rather quiet. It's not that they were not supportive, but they certainly weren't as vocal and, you know, outside that people were seeing this, you know, that they weren't leading the charge.
Well, right. And I make the argument at the beginning of the article that Orthodoxy cannot boast a Heschel. Absolutely not. Rabbi Saul Berman writes that he was in Selma. Rabbi Riskin has written that he also participated in the Selma demonstration. I think Rabbi Berman, if I'm not incorrect, I think he was actually arrested.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Boston sent an interdenominational rabbinic delegation down there, Rabbi Foreman, Emmanuel Foreman from the Young Israel of Brookline, traveled to Selma. We have written records of that. It was written about in the Jewish Advocate in Boston. So Orthodox rabbis and lay people did participate, but certainly that famous photograph of Martin Luther King and Rabbi Heschel, Dr. Heschel, we had nothing similar to that.
Well, you know, just to kind of get off the subject just for 1 second, because in the article you talk about how, you know, this was greatly appreciated by the African-American community and their leaders, you know, for the Jewish participation. And yet today, somehow, it seems to be a forgotten. Why is that?
From the Orthodox participation or the Jewish-wide?
No, in general. I mean, I just think, you know, the Jewish participation was so prominent, you know, and yet today among a lot of the African American leaders, you know, you don't hear that much about it anymore. Those early days, you don't hear the recognition for what we did.
Well, very few people recall that some of the founding members of NAACP were Jewish. It's an interesting question. The rise of the Black Power movement. Certainly by the 70s and 80s, there are plenty of articles written in the, for example, the Agudas Israel's Jewish Observer, RCA's Tradition. Many different commentators offering suggestions on how to bridge and to repair relations between African Americans and Jews, and not just Orthodox Jews. As Jews move into more suburban neighborhoods, the ties become that much weaker. And certainly it doesn't help. You look in the writings of Malcolm X, and he has certain negative things to say about the Jewish participation in the movements. It does begin to disintegrate over time. Certainly issues of affirmative action. One of the focal figures in my article is Rabbi Emanuel Rackman. He was probably the closest thing we had to a Heschel, and yet when it came to affirmative action, Rabbi Rackman opposed it with all of his might.
Really?
And that was in concert with many Jewish leaders, which obviously created a wedge between the agendas of the African-American community and the Jewish one.
No, I mean, I guess in their mind, you know, freedom, you know, to participate meant to participate, you know, on equal footing with everyone else.
Recall that that Jews were barred from certain levels of higher education. 1921, 1922, A. Lawrence Lowell, president of Harvard, minimized drastically the admission of Jews. There was a famous an NCAA. Halfback. There weren't called running backs at the time. They were called halfbacks or fullbacks. Changed his name from Horowitz to Halloween in order to fool the admissions committee to allow him to attend Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
So Rackman knew this. Rackman was already an elder statesman in the Jewish and the Orthodox community. He realized how far Jews had gone, to what lengths they went to reach certain echelons in higher ed, and he wasn't willing to compromise that effort for anything.
And in the article, you talk about, you know, some of the great you know, the rabbis that we know in the Orthodox Jewish world, Rabbi Drachman and Rabbi Young and Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik and Rabbi Pinchas Teitz, who were really very strong advocates for, you know, for civil rights. And you mentioned about how Rabbi Young compared Dr. Martin Luther King to Moses. And
yes.
And Rabbi Teitz talked about how we're trying to break down the walls of Jericho. And, you know, that's interesting. I don't think most people realize that.
Right. It was civil rights, because it was such an American cause, became woven into not just Western literature, but in a sense the theology of Jews, and Orthodox Jews were no different. This is something we might expect. Of course, I hint at it in the article at the end, from how we departed from there is the Soviet Jewry movement that picks up in the late 60s, 70s, and certainly by the 80s. What you have is a different cause. And that really just assumes a center stage, so to speak, for the Orthodox world.
Right. And you talk about how Yeshiva College, Yeshiva University, played a role, and they had committees, and at the Orthodox Union, which I guess I certainly didn't know about. You said the Orthodox Union established a special committee to enable Orthodox Jews to better partner with African-American civil rights.
It was the staff, actually, at Jewish Action that found that particular source. I'm very grateful.
Oh, really? Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
For their investigative.
That's wonderful. That's really interesting. But certainly, I guess...
Certainly.
Go ahead. Go ahead, please.
No, please.
Well, you know, I'm going to say that, you know, I mean, Jews always feel a kind of a moral and religious duty to, you know, uphold the rights of other people and our fellow man. So it would be logical, wouldn't it, that the Jews would be in the forefront of this?
Yeah, I think absolutely so. We found a different civil rights movement. Not to say that Jews moved away from supporting the African-American and minority causes, but certainly the Free Soviet Jewry movement just was an overwhelming cause that, in terms of the Orthodox community, the right, the left, the center, all took up arms to really negotiate and help and support that effort. It just meant priorities. There are only so many resources, only so many sermons, and so much fundraising you can do for an effort. But it is a really forgotten chapter.
Right. And so let's talk a little bit about Rabbi Rachman, because he was probably the most important Orthodox rabbi on the scene, who really felt strongly about this, and he did some interesting things, including bringing it to the RCA convention. So let's talk about what he did and the role of this fellow, a very interesting Maxwell Rabb, who was the associate counsel to President Eisenhower, and what he did and how that worked.
Right. So Rabbi Rachman has had scholarship written about him since his passing a number of years ago. As you say, he was one of the towering figures of the Orthodox community. Certainly never mistaken for a right-wing Orthodox Jew. He first eschewed the title of modern Orthodox, didn't like it very much. He writes that in 1969. But he comes around and he calls himself modern Orthodox. He's the rabbi first in Farakaway, and then becomes rabbi, I believe, the Fifth Avenue Synagogue. The assistant to Dr. Samuel Belkin at Yeshiva University, so he was one of the top officials at that particular university. And then he becomes the president and chancellor of Bar Ilan. He moves to Mixali, I believe, in 1976 or 1977. He's always championed certain the moral cause, the moral compass of the Orthodox community. Again, never accepted by everybody, but he is slated to become president of the Rabbinical Council of America in the mid-50s. He is the convention chairman and vice president in 1953-1954, and therefore it's his program, and it's his agenda to keep pace with the reform and conservative movements. So he insists at a conference, at the annual convention in Detroit, to address the Brown versus Board matter. I believe 800 rabbis attend the conference in Detroit, and in the Eisenhower Library, there are preserved documents of his correspondence with Rab and with other people in the Eisenhower administration to bring somebody from that office, from the White House, to address specifically Brown versus Board. He is adamant. We would love to have somebody, but somebody who will speak to the issue of civil rights and the desegregationist movement. And he does. And he's incredibly successful.
And he brings him to the convention. What I want to interested in finding out is, so what was the reaction, do you know, to his speech, to Rab's speech and his call for kind of action, and you know, that we in the Orthodox community should not forget, like you call the cruel injustice through the centuries, etc., so that we unfortunately suffered. So, you know, what was there, after he spoke, was there a call to action? Were there subcommittees that met, or what happened?
Well, we know that there were subcommittees. We know we have a letter addressed from Rabbi Rathman to Rab, which congratulating and say how wonderful the speech was and how well received, and one could tell by the commotion afterward and the questions asked to the White House representative, that it was well received. Of course, one would prefer another source, as a historian, one would prefer another source to corroborate Rathman's biased position, but we don't have that. It doesn't seem to have made the newspapers. Sometimes the RCA invited guests and reporters to report through the media to the Jewish world on what had transpired at the conventions. It doesn't seem that somebody either was invited or took that initiative and wrote a story, so we don't know much about it. But you can tell by the efforts of people like Rabbi Jung, Leo Jung of the Jewish Center in Manhattan. You can tell by Rabbi Teitz, chief rabbi, I believe was his official title, in Elizabeth, New Jersey, that it wasn't ephemeral. That rabbis in particular took an effort, and they combated a prejudice. There was the assumption, I just recently actually came across an editorial in the Jewish Spectator, a well-known, no longer around, periodical, in which somebody writes that all Orthodox lay people and rabbis are slumlords and mistreat their minority tenants. And the editorial was responded to immediately by a number of Orthodox elements saying, how could you say this? It's just not true. A response that didn't come actually in the Jewish Spectator, but actually in Chavrusa, the rabbinical alumni journal of Yeshiva University, was Rabbi Maurice Lamb, a scholar and a leader in his own right, whose brother, of course, is Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, the former president and chancellor of Yeshiva University, who was trying, how could this person say this? We need to make a greater PR effort, writes Rabbi Maurice Lamb, to combat such disparaging comments in the media. So the Orthodox world was always on uphill battle, trying to combat the impression that they weren't involved. That's why Rachman was so gung-ho, was so earnest in bringing in somebody to really sensitize, even more than they already were, the Orthodox rabbinate, to the civil rights cause. And that's why people like Rabbi Maurice Lamb, Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, for example, is very involved in the civil rights movement, spoke at Young Israel conventions, Orthodox Union dinners. But always combating a certain caricature of the Orthodox slumlord.
Do we know whether Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik ever marched in any demonstrations?
I'm not aware. I'm not aware. There was a book, an online periodical, I believe, put out by the family a number of years ago. I've read through it. I think it's available online. And there is nothing. Certainly, Ravon took a much more vocal role in the Vietnam. He's very much opposed to the war then. I believe in his published writings, we have essentially a transcript from one of the talks he delivered at a Young Israel convention, I believe, in the mid-60s. So I'm not sure if he marched, but certainly was a vocal authority and element in the Orthodox world.
Well, you know, these topics are so fascinating, and American Jewish history, which you're obviously you are an expert in, and you're getting your doctorate in, is a really a wonderful, wonderful subject, and it's one that always fascinates me, and people don't know that much about it. And so we don't have about another minute. I want to ask you just a quick question off the topic. So what do you think is a little-known fact that you found out about American Jewish history that most people don't know at all or would be surprised about?
Well, in terms of my research, what is the most surprising element
that I found? That the listening audience would say, you know what, never knew that. That's really fascinating.
I think, and I have yet to write on this particular topic, but the waxing and waning of the argument of Masorah. Too often, the Orthodox response to outward elements is it's against the Masorah. And I've taken a look to see how far back that that word, Masorah, goes. Of course, people could use it. The same effect is when it's against our tradition. 1959, Norman Lamb found the periodical tradition. So that word does go far back. But it's interesting to see how traditional and Orthodox elements aren't satisfied with simply arguing it's against our Masorah. They want something with more heft and more depth. I'm thinking right now, for example, there was a debate in the 1840s and 1850s. I just actually taught this, discussed it with some of my students at Maimonides School just yesterday in the 11th and 12th grade, about the debate over whether or not the Talmud is divine. And what if it's divine? Which component? The Midrash HaTorah Midrash of the Hem, the sort of the toolkit, the Gezeirah Shavos and the Hekesh and the Minyanav. Excuse me if we're not going into greater depth on what exactly those mean. But the tools that the Tanayim and the Moraim use in the Talmud to develop a halacha, is that divine, or is every single debate between Rav and Shmuel or Baye and Rava, are all of their debates somehow also handed down to Moshe at Har Sinai?
Interesting. And this was actually in the 1840s, you said that you saw this.
And then the debate, and then in the 1840s, there was a strident debate between Orthodox parties, and it was actually happening in Europe too. For so many hundreds of years, it's anachronistic to say this, but Jews adopted the position of the Rambam. In Hilchot Maamrim, and in the introduction to Mishneh Torah, the Rambam writes explicitly that only the Halacha of Moshe Mi-Sinai and the Midot Torah Midrash of them, the Binyan Av, the given at Sinai, and everything else was sort of developed. Tremendously gifted Talmidei Chachamim, not to disparage of Simon HaMoraim, but he actually had nothing nice to say about the Gaonic view that, in fact, every single word and letter of the Talmud came from Sinai. And that a Samson of Paul Hirsch in the 19th century, probably to oppose reform, who actually, this was a good device to challenge the authority of the Talmud, because if there was one component that was man-made, then maybe everything can be changed.
It's incredible. I think the thing is that, you know, as I was saying, that, you know, they're talking about this back in the 1840s. Well, you know, we can go on and on, but I think if people who are going to enjoy the article very, very much, Brown versus the Board of Education, an Orthodox cause, and we've really been, it's been a pleasure to have you on. Rabbi Letha and Rabbi Eleth, and I'm sure you're going to write other articles, and we'll be hearing a lot about you. So thank you so much for coming on the program. I really appreciate it. Have a great day, okay?
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. Cool, too.